Hello. There's a way to start a match commentary, and there's Michael Corcoran's way to start a match commentary.
Damien, thanks indeed, and welcome to Shizuoka, or should I say, the Aviva Stadium on tour, because that is what is right in front of us here at this iconic venue with a capacity crowd of 50,889, and there is an absolutely gigantic Irish crowd here in Japan in the foothills of Mount Fuji over the top back of the stadium ahead of this game. Bernard Jackman, this is just an incredible place to be.
Yeah, it's incredible to be here. I got the bullet train down this morning. The amount of Irish and Japanese fans making their way from Tokyo and all parts of Japan, and yeah, I haven't seen an atmosphere like this before. It's something to behold.
Wasn't that exhilarating? That was last Saturday morning on RTE Radio 1. And if you'd left it at that and, say, turned over to RTE Pulse, where they were playing Ian Audi's soothing music, it would have been a lovely Saturday morning altogether.
Here back with CJ Stander, hammers into some fella there as he tried to stop him.
And even if you switch back to RTE Radio 1 at 8:30, things between Ireland and Japan were still tipping along nicely.
It's Gary Rose, Gareth that one. Gary Ringrose swivels out of the tackle. 13 and a half minutes gone. It was Earls a few minutes ago.
But as the morning went on, Ian Audi on RTE Pulse seemed like a safer bet than Michael Corcoran on Radio 1 if you were looking for a stress-free Saturday morning.
And he comes up now and hits this one, strikes it quite well, gone towards the post, and the place in Shizuoka erupts. Japan have got their third successful kick-it goal. Lets it there now for CJ Stander, back towards Conor Murray. Conor Murray now in Ireland, bring it towards the 22-metre line. That's the Japanese 22-metre line. Available for Sean Cronin. Moves it out now, and that ball is intercepted. And all of a sudden, Japan come away with this one. And it's Ireland under pressure. This is going to seal the game as they race inside the 22. He is stopped 4 yards short of the line. Keith Earls gets back there, looks to try and gather the ball. He's knocked it on. It's going to be a scrum. The scrum will be for Japan with 77 and a half minutes gone. They've lost control of it. It's knocked on with 7 seconds remaining. So advantage for Ireland, who've got to get to the other end of the pitch. The referee to Murray. Back there now towards Dave Kilcoyne. The gong is gone. Back with Conor Murray. Conor Murray to Joey Carberry. Joey Carberry kicks it down the field and kicks it into touch on the near side of the pitch. And you have to say, to be fair, that is a rather strange decision. Kicking the ball into touch. Time up, but the time is still your friend. Joey Carberry kicks it out, and it's gone into touch. The referee's blown the full-time whistle. Japan have taken control of this one.
Oh, it's unbelievable. The credit to the Japanese. They absolutely deserved it. They played most of the rugby.
Michael Corcoran and Bernard Jackman on the Ireland-Japan disaster on Radio 1, and Ludovico Ainaudi's writing poems on Nick Chicane's programme on RTE Pulse, both on Saturday morning. Then on Sunday morning, easily the maddest story of the week popped out of John Bowman's programme. It was about the time RTE radio producer Pruntius O'Conloon found himself up the north talking to a man about a dulcimer. I don't know if you've seen that Peter Cook Dudley Moore sketch about them being harassed by film stars. They're two ordinary blokes in the pub, flat caps, warm beer, and for example, Peter Cook is complaining that he can't get sleep at night because Greta Garbo keeps knocking on his bedroom window trying to come in for a bit of romance. Anyway, the story told in John Bowman's programme by the fellow with the dulcimer echoes that sketch, and it's so out there that you wonder if any of it is true.
I suppose you've had a lot of visitors here from time to time, John.
Oh, yes, people interested in music and then hear the record that come out at that time. They were anxious to see the man in person play an instrument. And we met some famous people too. Before I left the Tugs there, I was coming home one evening and a wee bit early for the bus. You see, I got the train down to Larne and then the bus from Larne to Glenarum. A wee bit early for that, as I was going to the Laharna Hotel for a drink, then for a bottle of beer. And there were a lady sitting in where I went into. I didn't go way up into the bar. And up into the bar and got the drink, come out and sit down. And there were a lady sitting having a drink herself. And then she mentioned time of day and weather and one thing. So I, she come on over and joined me. So I went over and says, I'm waiting on the bus for Glenarum. And says, I'm a wee bit early, so I just come in for a drink. Asked she have a drink with me. And then look on here and she, I think you don't know me. Well, we may play in the dulcimer here, there and everywhere. Says I, no, I don't know you. Say, where did we meet? Have we met away about the south of Ireland? No, says she, I think we never met. Says she, my name's Sophie Lorraine, the film star. So I didn't know where I was sitting for a good minute. And I took a good look at her then. Oh, says I, and who you all right when you say who you are, so you're very real looking. But I think she had a wig on, her hair just wasn't as dark as what the Italian people are. Mm. But she said that evening, she said, don't worry about a bus getting home. She said, I'll hire a taxi and I'll go down. I told her before this about having a record out. Say, you're in the films, and I was telling her about having a record out with a dulcimer. It's a very rare instrument. Oh, she, I'd love to hear it. Have you it at home? Say, the record's at home and say, the dulcimer's at home. She said, we'll hire a car and we'll go down and I'll hear it. So she took a taxi down, her and I, and stopped out at the gate there, and she came and she heard the dulcimer. Oh, the very nice girl she is, very nice girl to talk to. So she was listening to the dulcimer. But she said, when you hear it in person, she said, it's far nicer than on the record. Well, she said, you're hearing the three instruments in the record, but away you just hear the dulcimer. So she stayed for about half an hour that evening. She said if ever she was back in this country, she would call and see me. But
She hasn't been back since, anyhow.
She hasn't been back since, so.
Yes.
Not for want of trying, I'd say. From Bowman, Sunday 8:30, the archive programme. Another archive programme worth mentioning this week is the brainchild of one of RTE Radio's archivists, Robert Canning. Over the past few years, Robert's been putting aside any clips he's heard in the archives that feature children on Radio Éireann or RTE. And when he had enough clips gathered, he made a series of programmes called Children at the Microphone. And one of the clips that Robert found ended up on The Late Late Show and The Graham Norton Show. It was of a 9-year-old Saoirse Ronan talking to Gerry Ryan. Anyway, the Children at the Microphone series charmed its way onto the shortlist for the Oscars of Irish Radio, the IMROs, and the ceremony is this week. And one of the clips that helped it get there is from a sponsored programme presented by Gay Byrne in 1969, when a crossed telephone line got them an unexpected caller.
Hello?
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 Is that Daddy?
Who is that?
Derval.
Derval?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, no, this is not Daddy.
Oh.
Derval who?
Brannock.
Derval Brannock?
Yeah.
Hmm. And what do you want, Derval?
I want Daddy.
You want Daddy?
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid Daddy isn't here, you know. What did you want to say to Daddy?
That I'm home.
That you're home?
Yeah, I'm home from school.
I see. And why do you think he'd be interested in knowing that you're home from school?
What?
Forget it. Why do you want to tell him that you're home from school?
Because he's supposed to collect me and someone else collect me.
Oh, I see. What school were you in?
Mockridge.
Uh-huh. And your daddy is supposed to collect you every day, is he?
Not every day.
Not every day?
No.
Just some days?
Yeah.
Hmm. So you wanted to say to him that now you're home so he doesn't have to collect you?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, now, will he be bringing you back to school?
I don't know. Well, I don't go back to school yet.
No, do you mean... Well, you'll be going back this afternoon, won't you?
I won't, no.
Oh, you won't? Why not?
I'm only 5.
Oh, so you don't go back to school when you're only 5. Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, how old do you have to be before you're allowed to go back to school in the afternoon?
I don't know.
Ah, they'll tell you someday, will they?
What?
They'll sort of come up to you someday and say, now you're old enough to come back. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
And then you start going back again.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, you haven't had lunch yet, have you?
What?
You haven't had lunch.
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Oh, you have had lunch.
What?
You've had lunch today, have you?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, look, I don't know where Daddy is, but if he blows in, I'll let him know what you had to say anyway.
All right.
All right?
All right.
Okay. You don't know who this is, do you?
No.
No? I didn't think you would. Where are you phoning from anyway? Home?
Yeah.
Yeah, and where's home?
Barton Road East.
Who?
Barton Road East.
There's a road east. I see. Yeah, very good. All right, then. Derval, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lovely name, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, Derval, thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Great. I don't know who it was, but it was Derval, and she lives in Homsley Road East. And if Daddy is listening, well, don't call for her because she's home already. She hasn't had lunch, of course, but she's home and she's not going back.
Gay Byrne and Derval Brannock from Radio Éireann in 1969 and part of the Children at the Microphone series on RTE Radio 1 Extra, the digital channel. One of the weirdest verbs turned up on Radio 1 Extra, roach motelling. A roach motel is a trap for cockroaches. It's a small cardboard box filled with a smell that attracts the roaches, but it's also lined with a sticky substance that traps them inside once they get there. The verb roach motelling describes the practice of online companies to hold on to you once you engage with them.
It's like when you've gotten yourself set up with a service and you want to discontinue it, try and find out how you do it. I mean, like, the King Kong master of roach motelling is Amazon. If you set up an Amazon account, you know, you can go there right now and set up a new account just to see how this works, and you set it up, try to see if you can figure out how you delete it again. I mean, it can be done, but it'll take you 30 seconds to set up the account. It'll probably take you half an hour to figure out how you get rid of it again.
Soren Kenner is the author of a book called Offline, about how to escape from technologically induced stress. But his background is in marketing. And he says companies like Facebook provide incredible tools for advertisers.
It will give me a lot of help in understanding my target audience, that I'm interested in reaching women between the age of 40 and 49 with a propensity to travel that live in one of these three states in the U.S. that are also interested in vampire fiction from Stephanie Meyer, just to take an example, right? A group like that can be built, it can be identified, and it can be marketed to. And then obviously what happens is once you start marketing to that particular group, something that you believe will be of interest to them, you see how they respond, right? So you have many of these groups operating at the same time. And then you just start picking the winners, right? So the groups that you'd sorted out, probably automatically, then as you start selling your stuff and it doesn't respond, well, you just close your marketing to those groups, stop spending money on them, where the ones that seem to be performing well, well, you augment and boost and make that group larger. And so everybody does this. So this means that this type of marketing over time, it gets more and more accurate. It gets more and more able to predict.
But Soren Kenner thinks those marketing tools are limited in their ability to influence.
There's a lot of research out there to tell you that information that you have about people's interest, values, affinities, purchase patterns, it makes it easier for you to sell them products and services, but it doesn't necessarily make it easier for you to persuade them that they should change their set of values or ideas. Absolutely, you can show that both the Trump campaign, the Brexit campaign, put money into Cambridge Analytica, that this money was spent building databases that use cohort analysis later to email market very large segments of the voter population with messaging that would be thought to resonate with where they were, which is, you know, fair enough, but I actually don't think it would probably work that well because the facts just are that it's much, much harder to market changes of attitude and values than it is to market specific products and services.
He says that the tricks used to keep us engaged online may be good for marketers like him, but not necessarily for society.
Technoference is when technology or social media or any other thing breaks into processes that are needed in order for socialization or families or friendships or anything else to work. So one of the best examples of this, you can observe it if you go to any playground. So you've got the kids carting around doing somersaults, being on the swings, whatever. And obviously they're doing what kids always do. They're going like, see me, see me, see me, because that's what it's all about. It's about that recognition and being part of something with your parents. But the parents are sitting on the bench and they've got their noses stuck into their cell phones, right? So they're not seeing little Jack doing cartwheels and being on the swing. And because little Jack is not being seen, well, he ends up thinking that the correct way of living your life when you get older is to have your nose stuck into the phone and not pay attention to the people that are actually looking for your attention in the real world. And even worse, obviously, it is that you can measure this. You go to that playground and you take a sample or blood test of the parents that were looking at their smartphone versus the parents that were focused on their kids' behavior and what they were doing, and you will see that the oxytocin levels will overall on average be higher for the parents that were focused on their kids than for the parents that were focused on a piece of technology.
Soren Kenner on The Innovation Show on Radio 1 Extra. The influence of sticky mobile media came up on Today with Sean O'Rourke. Shane Bergen from UCD was in to talk about the science of traffic and a new phenomenon of cars pulling away late from traffic lights.
So when a light goes green, why doesn't the traffic move as one unit?
I've often wondered.
Yeah. So you see the one at the front and then the one behind, and you get this kind of wave of things moving off. Mobile phones are having a hugely detrimental effect on traffic because it's reducing our reaction time, sometimes considerably. We've all been behind somebody and you see this expanse of road in front of the car in front of you, and you're like, why is that car not moving? And it's often because they're distracted, and the most distracting thing you have in your car at the moment is probably
so they're breaking
your mobile
the law
phone.
As well as holding people up behind them.
I walk up Foster's Avenue every morning to get into UCD, and I'd say every second car stopped in traffic, the driver has a mobile phone in their hand.
Shane Bergen says that traffic jams are caused by the number of cars on a particular stretch of road, obviously, but it's not the physical presence of the cars, but the fact that there are more and more drivers interacting with each other and not doing it that well.
Say if you're driving out west on a Tuesday morning and everyone is in work, you have the road to yourself. That's called free flow conditions. So you basically don't realise there's anyone else around you, and you're motoring along and you're happy out. However, you might take that same route at a busy time, and you'll start to notice there's more and more cars around you. And you do know that it gets to a certain point where things start to jam up. And what happens is all of the interacting cars, all of the cars are sort of interacting with each other. So drivers are making split-second decisions based on vehicles around them. And as the density of cars on the road starts to increase, you actually reach a critical point, and it's called the jam density. So when the number of cars on the road exceeds, it's roughly about 200 cars in any given mile of road in any lane, the cars will start to stop. And for sometimes for no reason. We'll all have been on the motorway when the cars ahead of you, that you can see the brake lights coming on, and this wave of brake lights comes back to you, and all of a sudden the traffic stops and you crawl along, and for no obvious reason then you start going again. And these are called phantom traffic jams. So we are able to look at the car in front of us and make split-second decisions on it, but we will have to adjust continuously. And one of the biggest issues for causing traffic is we drive too close to the car in front of us. And as the density of cars on the road increases, we start to get closer and closer to our neighbouring cars. And it doesn't give us enough time to make these minor adjustments to keep traffic flowing.
Now, I gather that scientists at MIT in Boston have been looking into all of this. Have they come up with anything?
Well, they have and they haven't. They've been able to describe exactly what's happening, which is useful because that allows city planners and others to go and then design roads and design vehicles to make things better. They've been able to model these phantom traffic jams. And what happens is you're driving along, there might be a car in the middle lane of a motorway, and it's moving relatively slower than the other traffic, right? So it's going quite slow and cars have to pull around it. And what happens then is you get this wave of delay coming backwards, and it moves backwards at around 20 kilometres an hour, and they've been able to look at how those interactions play out, and they've said that if cars were able to maintain more or less equal distance in front of them to the next vehicle and behind them to the vehicle behind, then we'd minimise the amount of traffic jams. And so they say that this isn't actually something that's pie in the sky. We all have the cruise control in our cars now, so if you're on a motorway and you're able to set your car such that it maintains a space between you and the car in front and the car behind, this could allow you to move.
So it wouldn't so much, Shane, be cruise control as a distance control, sorry, speed control as opposed to distance control.
Exactly, yeah. So it would keep you kind of safely away from the cars in front and behind.
That image of the cars slowing down in ripples back on the road, it's kind of balletic and fascinating. Unless, of course, you're in the middle of it. Shane Bergen from UCD with Sean O'Rourke.
We are a family now. We're a family now. Somehow we got together. Forever now, and it's understood. It's understood. It's in the blood. It's in the blood. Little soul, Just look at us now. Out in the world, it's all in front of us, and we make them proud, and they raised us good. They raised us good, the best they could. Best they could. As we make our way, day will follow day, and in our hearts we carry ordinary magic beams. Everyone gets to hold a handful to do with as they please, and love can drift like a dandelion seed. It'll light the world. It's a stone bead. As we make our way, day will follow day, and in our hearts we carry hope.
Dandelion Seed from Cork band Greenshine, as heard on Roots Freeway on Radio 1. Motherhood was treated in three different ways on the radio this week, two pretty ordinary and one pretty extreme. On 2FM, Jennifer Zamparelli came across a phrase coined by a journalist to describe new mothers who are lost in the world of parenting so much that they annoy their friends. And the phrase is...
Dummy mummy. She wrote the following... I am so lucky. Most of my friends have not, thank God, turned into dummy mummies since the birth of their children. The baby crazies, however, are astonishingly uninterested in anything other than strollers and breastfeeding and bedtime routines, in the night garden, safety gates, and on and on and on and on. A list that ends inevitably with at least one grandiose statement about their own supreme fulfillment, as opposed to my barren misery.
And then Jennifer's listeners texted in.
Somebody says, seriously, dummy mummy, another term for women to put them down. Is there not enough pressure on women to stay the same? Don't slag them off. You don't know what's going on behind closed doors. Well said. Another texter says, hi, Jen. I am a new-ish mother, 10 months. And yeah, piss off, haters. I love being a mama. And if I committed myself to the gym or CrossFit the same way I commit to my little girl, no one would bat an eyelid. Yeah, that's a very good point. You ever meet anybody, or do you have a friend who's in CrossFit? They're just as bad. All they talk about is CrossFit. All they do is CrossFit. They're worse than new mommies, to be honest with you. Someone else says, Jen, I'm actually getting really emotional just listening to this topic. I am mourning the loss of several friends who have turned into dummy mummies. I think we'll stop using that term because I don't like it. I love all their children and I'm really happy for them, but would it kill them to change the topic of conversation from epidurals and night feeds to something I can actually partake in? Snore!
Sinead from a website, everymom.ie, then came on and she said they've been talking about new mothers on their site and they did an online survey of almost 4,000 women.
84% are fatigued. 73% overwhelmed, 64% feeling self-doubt, 58% anxious.
Jesus.
But the stat that really stood out to me was 62% of new mums in Ireland are feeling lonely. You know, so when you talk about the friendships and the relationship dynamics changing, there's an impact there on the mums too. You know, 62% are lonely.
That's a very high stat.
Surprising. Very high stat.
Surprising.
Very surprising, yeah. Considering that actually 86% have less than 5 hours by herself a week.
Mm.
You know, so she's constantly actually busy and with her kids, but she's lonely. She needs friendship. She needs relationships. And we asked about friendships and relationships, and we found that 64% said that their friendships are less strong since they became a mother.
As my mother said, kids are no company.
And they're no company. We need our friends.
Yeah.
We need our friends, you know. And the loss of identity is huge. 77% said that they were feeling a loss of identity. And 52% said that they miss being seen as more than just a mum. So when I heard this conversation this morning, I really thought, well, actually, the mums on this side of the fence, like, they don't want to be seen as just a mum either.
No. It must be tough on the friend with the no kids, though, because their friend has this whole new life and they probably feel a bit left out, and they can't really relate or understand a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
So what I think that has to be the case.
What do we do? What advice have you got for that person?
Find common ground. Accept that the friend that you might have always been out until 3 a.m. in the morning with, she's not there right now. She's in a really intense phase of her life.
Mm.
But find ways that the two of you can mutually, you know, do things that you both enjoy and you can both do, and schedule it in. Mothers have no spontaneity, right? Spontaneity is gone. So if you want to see your friend, schedule it in and find something that you can both do in the time that you have. And just reconnect, you know, and get that magic back. You were
connection,
friends for a reason.
Yes, connection is so important. I got a text in here saying, I have an 8-month-old and a 3-year-old, and my friends of 10 years dumped me. I was the first to marry and have kids. They had no interest, haven't even seen my second child. They never text or ring. I get a happy birthday message from some of them every year. Their loss, I guess, but it's so sad. From Christina.
Yeah, we hear that all the time. I've experienced it myself. It's you know, people, when you're in this intense phase, everything changes. And I think that you discover the people who are really there for you and maybe the people who are just kind of more social friends.
Oh, I went through it as well. I did a good L clear out now when I had the kids.
Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM. Another new mother considering a clear out, featured in one of the winning stories on the Francis McManus Short Story Award on Radio 1. Her name is Stella, and the clear out she's considering is not of her friends, but of her husband.
The day had started with her not recognising her husband's underwear. She had walked into the bathroom as Mark stood washing his teeth in boxer shorts and a white T-shirt. They were a dusty blue colour and covered in a tiny print of grey airplanes and cars. She took a cotton bud to her ear and perched on the edge of the bath to get a closer look. They didn't look particularly new. The cotton stood out slightly from his legs, retaining a certain crispness, but she could tell they had been through the laundry more than once. Had she washed them? Had she bought them? She couldn't be sure anymore. Maybe he had picked them up on one of his business trips. They were so frequent now that she'd stopped looking for a gift home and surprises were no longer produced. Stella held no desire to be a kept woman, but there were days when she would have been grateful for a tiny reminder that there was more to life than nappies and bottles. A hotel room biro probably would have done the trick. Occasionally, she would email him to pick up a gift for someone for whom novelty or exclusivity was required. But it had become tiring and pointless to keep up to speed on his life abroad. Stella could no longer explain his job to a friend who asked. A few short years ago, she would have known the names of all his colleagues and the big deals they were working on. She would have picked up on industry news and talked about it over dinner. He would have asked her opinion on a pending press release or a presentation he was finalising. But over time, she knew she had to let the tide of motherhood wash her out to sea. She was unwilling, however, to replace business chat with house and baby chat, because that risked their evening descending into a who had the busier day contest. It was a tricky one. If you had makeup on and there weren't any cereal bowls in the sink well, then you looked like you had time on your hands. If, on the other hand, you were clearly still wearing your pyjama top under your fleece and the nappy bin hadn't been emptied, you looked like you weren't coping. Did she want sympathy for Mark? Hell no. She had imagined that they would have this feeling of being in this together. But maybe it was okay to admit that you were no longer terribly interested in how your life partner spent their day. But standing in the bathroom that morning, she decided she wasn't going to care about the recent history of her husband's transport-themed underwear. And he sure as hell didn't care about what she was wearing. Just as well, given that she was wearing some random grey yoga cast-offs with a brooch of pureed pear on her left breast. She didn't kiss him when he left for the Eurostar. It was only a day trip to Paris and those trains never crashed.
Janet Moran reading an extract from The Boxer Rebellion by Liz Houchin. And you can find the full story on the RTE radio player from 7:45 on Sunday night. Another mother appeared on Arena, which came live from the Project Art Centre in Dublin in a special on Marina Carr's new play, Hecuba. Hecuba was the wife of the King of Troy during the mythical Trojan Wars.
I'm dreaming of our summer palace up in the high, cool mountains. The children splashing in the fountain. I'm woken by one of the servants, a Trojan girl. I think her mother was one of my dressmakers. Shh, she says, and leads me through the many cloth rooms, a passageway, where outside the sea near. She points to something. What is it, I say. Your son, she says, the young prince, Polydorus. And she kneels, kisses my feet. Poor queen, she says. Poor queen. Don't tell them it was me who showed you, and she runs off. There's a mound of them, piled like a haystack, the new dead, fresh dead since we landed here in Thrace. No smell yet. Small, stiff bodies, children mostly from what I can make out. Don't believe what I'm doing as I'm doing it, rummaging among them, looking for Polydorus. The doomed eyes, the ankle bones snapping, the fragile heads, some shorn, but most with the long silken tresses of our boys. How proud we were of our son's hair, didn't cut it to shoulder length till they were 10. I whisper sorry. Sorry as I disturb them, though I feel it is they who pity me. And there he is, on his side, looking past me. They didn't even close your eyes. I gather him up. He resists me, doesn't want my embrace now, will never want it again. No breath, none. You knew you would come to this day. In you, from the start, all gone now. And something akin to relief comes flooding in. You can put aside motherhood now. Take it off like a scarf, let it swirl and flow away from you across the shining sea. Hold his hard little body. His lips, when you touch them, are ice. Who did this? Who did this to my war baby born in the first year of these unimaginable times? I must bear this too, it seems.
Aisling McGuckin from Arena as the mythical Hecuba of Troy. The documentary on One came from that part of the world too, the Eastern Mediterranean, but it dealt with a story, sadly, very far from myth.
Yes! It's the 11th of August, 1996, and tensions on the divided island of Cyprus have reached fever pitch. Television screens across the country flicker with live images of a violent confrontation between the Greek and Turkish sides in a conflict that's already lasted decades. And it's taking place on a piece of scrubland designed to keep the two peoples apart. The pictures are coming from inside the United Nations buffer zone, known here in Cyprus as the Green Line. The shaky news cameras pick out a man lying in the dirt. He's motionless, yet his attackers are still beating him. A tall man in a UN police uniform forces his way through and pushes the mob back. He checks the beaten man for a pulse, but one of the attackers has returned and hurls a rock at his head. Cyprus has just witnessed a murder live on television. And this is the very soundtrack to that killing. The victim is Tassos Isaac. He was a local man from Paralimni in Cyprus. The UN officer who tries to save him is Garda Frank Flood, a policeman from Kilkenny.
I was angry. Who do these guys think they are, killing this guy for what? For nothing.
In the years since, Tassos Isaac has become an iconic figure in the Greek Cypriot cause, his memory venerated by those who want divided Cyprus reunited. Unbeknownst to Frank Flood, his actions have not been forgotten either.
I'll tell you, we'll never forget you. Never.
Although he has never spoken publicly of the bloody events of that August afternoon, Frank has come back to Cyprus.
Frank Flood and the other Gardaí were in Cyprus to police a buffer zone, keeping Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots apart.
And on a couple of occasions, people from this side ran forward to throw stones at people on that side over there. So the Greek Cypriots ran forward and the Turkish Cypriots would throw stones back. And they were using these slingshots, and then every so often a soldier would shoot into the air. I can recall on one occasion thinking everything that goes up must come down. And at that point, when I thought about that, a little puff of dust landed beside me, and I was very curious about what this puff of dust was. And I noticed a 9mm bullet had actually landed beside me. So what does go up does come back down again.
Frank's wife, Helen, had accompanied him to Cyprus in 1996 and returned with him for the documentary on One.
And, of course, Helen was at home watching all this on TV.
Yeah, it was very scary. I remember ringing the station, Pila, and I'm not sure who I talked to, maybe Stephen or someone. And I said, they're firing shots there, I said, and they don't even have bulletproof vests on or anything to protect themselves. And I just wanted to go down there and drag them out of it. And I remember him saying, stay put, you're not to get in the car, the Jeep, and drive down there. And I was like, I felt so anxious and so scared. But what could I do?
All she could do was wait.
Because of everything that happened, you had left early in the morning, and then as the day unfolded and I could see everything going on TV, but I had no contact with you. So I wasn't sure how you were, and
before mobile phones. No mobile phones.
I was in complete panic.
It would be a number of hours before Helen got Frank home.
But I do remember you arriving back at the house now, and I remember your shirt was covered in blood and things, and I looked at him, and I remember you just putting your hands up and you going, I'm okay. This is not mine. And I was just I must have been just grief-stricken standing at the doorstep, just wondering what had gone on and how you were. And it was just terrifying. Yes. Sorry. I was so worried about you.
3 years ago. I think I was an incredibly lucky guy. I could have been...
Yeah.
I could have gone the other way. But I didn't think about that at the time.
I did. Mm-hmm. I did, watching that unfold on TV. And how close it came to being you.
Helen and Frank Flood from Return to the Green Line, this week's Documentary on One, and you can hear the full programme on the Documentary on One app. This week, the government decided that, after all, history is an important school subject, and they gave it special status for the junior cert.
The Independent, in an editorial, speaks of a fathomless ignorance of history in the Brexit debate on both sides of the Irish Sea. The writer recalls that President Higgins, before the last presidential election, cautioned against turning our collective memory into hatred's forge, rekindling old conflicts rather than healing them. The best bulwark against any such impulse, according to The Independent, is to have a thorough understanding of where we have come from.
John S. Doyle from It Says in the Papers, incidentally on the day that RTE Current Affairs devoted itself to programmes about a no-deal Brexit. A sure way of persuading people of the value of history, but another, perhaps better way to persuade them is that they listen to this week's History Show with Miles Dungan. It was all about cock-ups, vandalism, clever stunts and accelerants. They were talking about the War of Independence and the IRA trying to burn down British centres of administration.
Yeah, there's a number of courthouses and RIC barracks burnt out in Limerick that go quite badly for the IRA and actually cost them more casualties than ambushes at the time. I'm thinking of Drumcullagher Courthouse in West Limerick that was burned in 1920. Three IRA volunteers killed in that, and four IRA volunteers killed in 1921 when they tried to burn Croom Courthouse. And the thing that happens there is the IRA, the flammable liquid these men would have been used to was paraffin from paraffin lamps at home. But for the first time, they're using petrol to commit these arson attacks, and they're not familiar with the dangers of petrol fumes. And often they spread out petrol, they see it soaked up, and they say, oh, we'll spread out some more. Somebody in the next room lights a match, and the fumes can just take off, and the whole thing goes up. And there's one infamous example. Kilmurry RIC barracks will be familiar to anyone who attended the University of Limerick. It's an old castle or tower house in ruins just near the UL campus. The IRA went in to set that on fire in 1920. One IRA volunteer was killed, John Colopy, and another one, Dennis Maher, was very badly wounded. And in that case, they'd set fire to the building. They looked back and they saw that there was a Catholic statue of the Virgin Mary. They didn't want to see that statue destroyed or damaged, so they rushed back in, and part of the wooden roof actually collapsed on top of them, and that mortally wounded Colopy. And incidentally, the statue did survive. Maher's granddaughter, who's married to Mickey Graham, a very well-known Limerick hurler from the 70s, they still have that statue, and they're its custodians today.
Dr. Pádraig Ó Gcóirc, historian. And then the programme dealt with what has often been said to be one of the worst acts of vandalism, the burning of the Custom House in Dublin in 1921. Now, the programme heard that given the IRA's ability at the time, this should have been a damp squib, but for help from a really surprising source. The Custom House was chosen for a couple of reasons by De Valera, as historian Liz Gillis explained.
He'd been in America for the majority of the War of Independence, so obviously newspaper reports are reporting or stating what's going on in Ireland, and it's not good. The IRA are seen as murderers and so on. It's not a legitimate army. So when he returns at the end of December 1920, he's coming back with that view that we are a legitimate army, we are a legitimate government, and we should engage in these big actions, but for the propaganda value that this will garner. So two targets are put forward: an attack on Beggar's Bush Barracks or the Custom House. And then you have the surveillance and the intelligence work going on as to which would be the most viable target.
And from a military perspective, Paul, which was the more viable of these two targets?
The Customs House would have been, and it's kind of a soft target. Beggar's Bush Barracks was the depot for the Auxiliary Division of the Royal Irish Constabulary, which were the toughest unit that the IRA came up against during the Irish War of Independence. So the Customs House would have been a very soft target compared to that. You might have a few policemen on patrol outside, but you wouldn't have had a military picket.
Historian Paul O'Brien. The IRA chose lunchtime to set the Custom House on fire.
They arrive outside the Custom House, the Bears Replace side of it. That's the way they actually go in. And this was timed for lunchtime. And as the lorries arrive, various groups of men start to go into the Custom House, take the couple of tins each, and then head into the building. Then they gather the staff. Now, they chose lunchtime because there wouldn't be as many people in the building. And while the staff are gathered, they're brought down to the main hall and guarded by the squad and the active service unit. Each volunteer was told where to go, and they were to close the windows and then prepare, get all the paperwork, pile them together, throw the paraffin on, and then one whistle blast would signal, and once everyone was ready, that they were to set fire to the contents.
Now, as you say, this is well covered by the military service pension collection, by the files there, by the Bureau of Military History. And in fact, you mentioned the squad. Vinnie Byrne, a member of the squad, described his involvement in his Bureau of Military History witness statement in that operation.
I proceeded to the second floor. I opened the office door, and sitting inside were a lady and a gentleman, civil servants, having tea. I requested them to leave, stating that I was going to set fire to the office. The gentleman stood up and said, "Oh, you can't do that." I showed him my gun and told him I was serious. He got very worried about the whole thing. I said to him, "You had better get out at once, unless you want to be burned alive." The lady asked me, "Could she get her coat?" And I replied, "Miss, you'll be lucky if you get out with your life." They then left. I opened a safe and removed all the ledgers. I collected all the other papers and files I could find and placed them on the table. I then proceeded to pour petrol over the office and on the papers. On hearing the signal, the whistle, I stepped outside. I lit a ball of paper, and slightly opening the door, I flung it into the office. In a flick, the whole office was ablaze.
Simon Delaney reading there. And of course, the documents that were set alight were valuable to British administration of the country at the time.
Paperwork to do with the Inland Revenue, local government, the estate duty registers, stamp duty, and also income tax as well.
But then those documents would also have been extremely valuable to historians today to tell the story of ordinary people's lives in the 1920s. The Custom House fire burned for 5 days in May 1921, and according to Laz Fallon, who is a retired firefighter and a historian of the Dublin Fire Brigade, this was for a very good reason.
Within the brigade, going from pension statements, going from speaking to the sons of some of these men in my own early days in the job, and going back to the records and to their own personal papers, they say that most of the people in the job were either volunteers on the active list, as they call them, or what they class as active sympathisers. People who would never have sworn an oath as an IRA man, but would be very well prepared to carry out operations on their behalf.
And one of those operations was, amazingly, rather than the firemen helping the British put out the Custom House fire,
they went into the building to assess the damage that had already been caused and to spread the fire into the remaining parts of it that hadn't been burnt. They go into the building, they take the unused cans of paraffin, they spread the fire into parts that haven't been spread into. And one of the firemen, Michael Rogers, who was an IRA volunteer, writing afterwards said, "We had the building practically at our mercy, and I can tell you now that many parts of it that were not on fire when we entered were blazing nicely in a short while."
Every step of the way, you can see how the fire brigade made feigned attempts to put out the fire. There was, of course, an ample water supply in the form of the River Liffey, which runs beside the building, but it seemed to take an extraordinarily long time to set up the hoses and produce any water.
If you look at newsreel, and this Pathé newsreel of the firemen at the Custom House, you see them with hoses, you see the water coming from the hoses, and by and large you see it hitting the walls of the Custom House and running onto the pavement. Very little of it seems to be going through the windows. There's no determined effort to save this building being made. In 1921 at the Custom House, they've moved over from being firefighters into basically being the arsonists who have the leisure to travel through the building and make sure that it burns. There are official reports from the British talking about the strange amount of rekindles, fires starting back in areas that they had thought had been dealt with.
Laz Fallon, Dublin Fire Brigade historian. And the result of all that? The destruction of all those records?
It actually catapulted Ireland onto the world stage because it hit the headlines all over the world that this happened in the capital city of Ireland. And that's what Dev and the IRA leadership wanted. They wanted this out there. It brought the British to the negotiating table in June, and then with the signing of the truce in July, and then the treaty.
Historian Paul O'Brien from The History Show on Radio 1. This is Jig Jam, a group from Offaly in Tipperary. They were heard on Áine Hennessy's programme Binnis Béal on Radio na Gaeltachta. Jig Jam with Red Paddy on the Ridge on Radio na Gaeltachta. And a couple of shorter, memorable moments from RTE Radio. John Creedon told how he had met a campaigner for the rights of indigenous people in Guatemala when he was in that country some time ago with Trocra, but that he had met the man in prison, where he was held because of his activism.
Awaiting trial for a charge of trespass, amongst other things, on a plantation where there had been a protest about land rights, and 800 days, almost 3 years, waiting for trial. But as I left that day, the doors kind of clanged shut behind us. I kind of thought, I'll never meet this man again.
John then explained how, the other day, he met the man in Cork. He had been released and was in Ireland to receive an award.
It was just a lovely moment to see him again and see that big smile on his face. what was it? He came up with the line today through a translator. He was saying that in Guatemala, he says, the government, he said, is like a snake. It'll always bite the shoeless people first.
John Creedon. And on the In the Wings programme on Sunday night on Radio 1, musician Creevy O'Reilly told how he plays an ingenious Norwegian fiddle called a Hardanger fiddle. This instrument has 10 strings, but as Creevy explains, he doesn't play all 10.
Five of the strings, you don't even play them. They're there to add resonance. And you bow the top five strings, and the five sympathetic strings just hear a note they like and grab it and resonate. And it's like a little faint echo for specific notes.
Creevy O'Reilly with his Hardanger fiddle on Radio 1. Also on Radio 1, on Drive Time, in advance of Storm Lorenzo, folklorist Michael Fortune was telling Sarah Hegarty about sayings he's come across in Newfoundland that are similar to ones he's heard here.
There's one classic one, it's a real bold one, whatever, I couldn't believe it. I was saying with a woman in St. John's, and she said, "Now, if I'm going to say this, this fella, if a man was handy, he'd put a something in a cat.
Arse in the cat.
Put an arse in the cat, is right. And I couldn't believe it, because my grandmother at home in Wexford used to use it. I said, I can't believe you're using that. And then he'd put an arse in the cat, or put a glass arse in the cat. And like, even I just put that stain up on my folklore.ie page on Facebook the other day, and sure, the amount of people, like, how connected both of us. There's loads as well. Just one woman as well, because we're thinking of this hurricane that's coming towards us now at the moment. She said that a hen would lay the same egg twice, meaning that the egg came out and the wind was so strong it blew back up again, and it laid it the second time. So,
Michael Fortune on Drive Time and Radio 1. The sports show on 2FM fielded a new team this week. See what I did there? Donegal O'Callaghan from the world of rugby, and Ruby Walsh from the world of racing, and presenter Mary Crowe. One of the first assignments for the two sportsmen was to jump the fence and go to a press conference and behave as journalists.
Donegal, you were with Mick McCarthy, Ruby with Pat Smullen. What was the experience like?
I found it really different. Of course, I was going to, but I suppose from a player's point of view, you're so guarded and you know the information you nearly don't want to get across. Whereas when you're sitting there, you want the nuggets, you want them to open up. I must say, media is quite comfortable. Lovely sandwiches, great soup. We were spoiled out in the Aviva. I was there. Why do all these journalists and reporters whinge?
Stop telling the trade secrets.
But one thing I did find really interesting was, you know that a coach, or you know that a person, won't answer a question. There's certain questions that were not going to be answered, but yet they're offered up the whole time. And I just found it unusual that, you know, it's nearly, I know the journalists have to ask the question, but I think, you know, the definition of madness is expecting a different outcome from a coach.
I agree with you. I took a much softer option. I just rang a friend and had a conversation with Pat Smullen. I went for a soft touch, but I get where Dunica's coming from. You know, as a sports person, that there's questions that aren't going to be answered. So why bother asking them?
You have to ask them, because you'd never know. Like, you know, you might catch someone on a moment of weakness, or they might just make a split second decision and just give you that answer. Like, it does happen. We have seen it, I think, especially post match interviews, some of the great ones we can get after a game. You don't want to ask people, are they going to quit? You think that they're not going to tell you, and then all of a sudden they go, you know what?
That's post match heat at the moment. This is a press conference early in the day when it's all staged anyway. It's a different thing completely. Post match, in the heat of the moment, you could get any reaction. God knows what someone could say.
Padraig Harrington that time, when he won the Open, that was just the greatest interview of all time, because someone put a mic under him at that moment where he was emotionally raw and he just opened up. And I love those moments where you actually get to see the real sports person.
I think as well, sometimes
adrenaline and all those things are flowing, whereas a press conference, you ask someone the wrong questions, are they going to talk to you again? That's part, to me, that's part of being a journalist. You have to know when to ask and when not to ask.
But sometimes you can read an awful lot into people not answering the questions. And I think last night, Ole Gullit Gunnar Solskjaer, him not answering the questions was very revealing of the situation that he was in, even though he kind of batted them away. I think listening to the journalists asking the questions and seeing his body language and his reaction just kind of told the story anyway.
It is just like the FAI shutting down since last Saturday night and saying nothing as well.
Ruby Walsh, Donegal O'Callaghan and Mary Crowe from Game On and 2FM. It was a week of waiting. Waiting for Boris Johnson's Brexit proposals and waiting for Storm Lorenzo.
Well, Derek Flanagan from the Irish Coast Guard Service has this advice for people during the storm.
We want people to be mindful of their own safety.
but also to be mindful that if they get into difficulty, that they'll also be putting at risk the lives of the crews that have to go and possibly rescue them. Stay back, stay high and stay dry.
Derek Flanagan of the Coast Guard on the News at 1. And as for waiting for Boris Johnson, the DUP's Gregory Campbell told Sean O'Rourke not to be rushing things.
For the value of a couple of hours, I think we need to hold our nerve and let's just see now the detail. And what I hope will not happen is that we will not get a knee-jerk reaction from Brussels or from Dublin. In the words of Margaret Thatcher, you're going to have to say yes to something.
Well, that's maybe a two-way street of negotiation as well.
Most of your listeners, I'm quite sure, are saying we're fed up
of course.
Listening to Brexit.
I don't know about people getting fed up. It's like one of those soaps that you keep telling yourself you should stop watching and go out and do a night class, and then someone starts doing the bold thing with someone they're not married to and... Jerry texted Sean O'Rourke with another take on it.
Jerry in Galway says, the argument that everyone is fed up with Brexit sounds like a parent faced with a screaming child throwing a tantrum. It finally gives in and buys the pony, even though they live in an apartment on the fifth floor.
And in fact, Coleman Nocter, when he came into the Ray Darcy show, sounded like he was echoing Jerry's text.
And the screaming match, which is inevitable, doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
Coleman is a child and adolescent psychotherapist, and he was in with Ray answering listeners' questions about parenting. The screaming row reference was in response to a parent asking how to deal with a son who has no interest in studying for the Leaving Cert.
Well, if I had the answer to this one, I'd stick it in a book. I mean, I'm doing this for 20 years and this comes up all the time. And it's a real issue because the one thing you can't make someone do is learn and study. And we need to be able to accept that that's not possible. In terms of we can incentivize, you can try and promote, but youth is wasted on the young in that sense that there isn't, we have the foresight of experience and life and know that if you put this in just for a year and if you just get to June, and it'll stand for the rest of your life. To the 17-18-year-old adolescent who's not really interested in that, that doesn't hold any weight whatsoever.
Okay. So what's your advice then?
I think it's incentivize, it's encourage. I would cut out the rows. I just think they achieve nothing, only creating a kind of a dig your heels in.
It sounds like
piece.
The studying thing has become a flashpoint.
Yeah, and the mere words of study or exams creates this trigger, and he's feeling nagged, he feels got at, and I just don't think that's going to be the result to it.
Then, as part of a general explanation on childhood anxiety, Coleman gave a sort of potted description of our development through childhood.
The process of childhood is the introduction of reality. So when you're 4, you think you're Superman. When you're 8, you kind of think, gosh, maybe I'm not Superman, and everyone else thinks they're Superman too. And when you're 10, you realise you're never going to be Superman. And when you're 14, you realise you couldn't be anything further than Superman. Do you know what I mean? So it's a process of becoming disillusioned. Do you know what I mean?
And there are anxieties associated with all those revelations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as they come into your life, you get more stressed. And the stress is not articulatable because it's so vague. So children find a way of expressing it through a fear of death, a fear of germs, a fear of this.
Psychotherapist Coleman Nocter with Ray Darcy. And just before I go, back to where we began and rugby. It may have brought us one of the low points of the week, but it also gave us a bit of a lift when Paul McKee came on to talk to Sean O'Rourke.
Now to the RT Radio Rugby World Cup competition and that fabulous prize of the return flights to Tokyo for two people, tickets to the World Cup final and €1,000 in spending money. We have Paul McKee on the line. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm great, but I'd say I'm not as well as you are. I think I've good news for you, Paul.
Oh, my God. Go on.
You're the winner.
Oh, my God. That was brilliant. No way. Oh, Sean, I'm absolutely over the moon. That is amazing. Oh, thanks a million.
Yeah, well, don't be thanking me. you thought you were coming on as part of a last roundup of maybe 4 or 5 people and then you were in with a chance. But no, you're the man. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Wow.
Who are you?
I work for Bus Air and I drive a bus in Dublin here. I'm 42. I'm mad about rugby. I love it. What can I say? I'm just over the moon.
have you played the game, Paul?
I haven't played the game. No, I haven't played the game, but I love watching it. I just love
I love the sport. I love the tactics. It's a beautiful game. It really is.
Enjoy the trip. We might talk to you from Tokyo before you start heading for home again.
Oh, you will.
Great stuff.
I'm delighted. Thank you so much.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1. And that's it for this week. And thank you to those of you who wrote with suggestions of clips I should play to playback@rte.ie. Until next week, slán.